Hi, I'm Malak Fouad, and welcome to What I Did Next from A&T Media. We're currently on our season break, and we'll be back with new episodes in September. In the meantime, I wanted to share my conversation from last year with businessman, art collector, activist, and academic Sultan Saud Al-Qasimi. It was a great conversation about his life's pivot points and his shift to academia, so let's listen in. Sultan is someone I have long admired from afar, a man who has worn many hats over the decades, businessman, art collector, activist, academic. A proud son of Sharjah in the UAE, Sultan's nationality, heritage, and deep sense of what it means to be Arab today is the thread that links all his work and interests. Sultan came to the attention of a wide audience in the Middle East and beyond for his activism during the 2011 revolutions in the Arab world. Initially helping Western journalists make sense of Arab language media, Sultan eventually became a source of news in his own right via his Twitter account. Of course, Sultan's story begins well before 2011. To understand who Sultan is, we look back to the early days of the UAE and discover a young boy in Sharjah in the 1980s. It was his family life and his outward-looking parents who helped mold his philosophy and, crucially, his love of art. Sultan and I discuss how this deep interest led to him building an immense art collection that takes in modern and contemporary artists from our region. We start our discussion today with our icebreaker questions. The first question is based on the Malcolm Gladwell book, The Tipping Point. I asked Sultan what personality type from the book he most associates with, a connector, a salesman, or a maven.
Although I identify with personality traits of all three, I think I tend to relate mostly to the connector. In my life, I felt always that as much as possible, good people should know each other and good people should help each other. People should help each other in general, but I think especially good people should help other good people in order to progress in the world. And this is what I've set myself out to do for almost 25 years, whether it was in my salons back home when I was a teenager, El Majlis, as we call it, whether it's introducing people online to each other just for no reason other than I think that they would fit well together. I feel like it's important that we as human beings reach out to each other and try to further these goals of enhancing humanity and bettering ourselves.
I feel like that's a good fit for you. And it's also the one I identify the most with. I enjoy making connections between people. I enjoy to see that my instinct is right on those things. But I think also, from what I know of you, a maven sounds like a pretty good description as well. Information specialist. I mean, there was a period in time, 2011, if we can go back to that, where you were the source of information for entire swathes of people. You know, journalists who couldn't speak Arabic were relying on you for immediate translations.
If I may, I think, being in that position, being in a position where you see an opportunity, you see a possibility, and you try and share some of the knowledge, some of the access that you might have. I think that's very, very important, especially in the world today. And there are now words for such individuals on social media. These are jobs, I think, that have come to life over the past few years that didn't exist a decade ago or 12 years ago. And so, yes, as I said, I feel like I identify with all these traits, and I was honored to have been part in to have played a minuscule, even tiny, tiny part in what happened 11 years ago, and what continues to happen in some places as well.
Our second icebreaker is based on social media. Does Sultan, who was in the past intrinsically associated with Twitter, have a social media preference these days?
Certainly, if you asked me this question a decade ago, I would tell you hands down, Twitter was my preferred platform. I also still use Facebook, but not as much. But certainly over the past 4 to 5 years, I have used Instagram more than any other platform. And I feel like I've gotten back from it more than any other platform. And I can tell you, if I may elaborate, that I don't have legacy issues with Instagram. I have legacy issues on Facebook and on Twitter. As in, my political engagement from 2008 to 2014 or 15 has already set in people's minds who this person is. And I get a lot of people who have expectations and who have preset notions of who I am and what I represent and what I post. And when I decided to pivot over the past few years into less posts about politics, let's say, and more about art and culture from West Asia, South Asia, North Africa, East Africa, the part of the world that I feel mostly connected to, I felt like there was some kind of pushback from Twitter and from Facebook, people saying, why aren't you posting about this? This thing's happening in the region. And I felt a little bit of pressure. On Instagram, it was a bit easier because I wasn't as active on Instagram 10 years ago. Instagram wasn't really as developed. And on Twitter, people, the conversations have become a bit problematic for me. Maybe it's the people I follow. Maybe it's the people who engage with me. But I found myself muting a lot of people. I found myself trying to disengage from people. I found the conversations becoming a bit problematic. And I am unable to sustain that level of engagement. And so I decided to slowly pull back. I still admire it. I think it's a fantastic platform for those who can use it. But for those mired in legacy issues, I think that we come with an added baggage that we can't disengage from. It's not easy to say, I was posting about politics for 8 years, but now I really just want to do art and architecture. People don't accept it.
I think people like to pigeonhole people, and they almost feel offended when you dare to do something else. Since you are using Instagram more now, what would be, if you could only follow five people on Instagram or five accounts, who would you pick if you had to delete everyone else?
Okay, so this is a very, very difficult question to answer, but I have struggled and I have thought about really what are the accounts, Malek, that add value to my life. I would like to start with an account called Arabic Words and then _0, I believe. And so this account presents phrases and words that the Arabic language provides us with, that we sometimes forget how beautiful our language is, and sometimes we just don't know the origin of words and what these words mean. And I remember one of their posts, Malek, was basically the same word repeated 6 or 7 times, and each one of them had a different meaning. And just, the, for example, the number of ways you could say the word love in Arabic is endless. And there's so much positivity going on to the second account that I really like. And these are not in any order. These are just accounts that I really like. An account that I've been following the past 2 years is Brown History. So Brown History finds a lot of interesting details and characters and individuals from my part of the world, the part of the world that I am most interested in. And they give you background. So they give you backgrounds about their history and their culture. And I remember just an account they posted recently was when the acclaimed Indian singer Lata Mangeshkar passed away. They came up with this lovely post about how Lata Mangeshkar was inspired by Umm Kulsum. And so this is something I didn't know about. I didn't know that there was this connection between South Asia and North Africa, this connection between Egypt and India, two countries that really mean so much to me. So that was a wonderful, wonderful example of, the post that Brown History comes up with.
I'm very interested in this. I don't know any of these accounts, so I'm going to go and look at them now. Yes.
Another account I really like was set up by a couple of young women, one from the Gulf and one from Europe, and it's Mathqaf. مثقف, which means some kind of knowledge or intellectual knowledge. مثقف from the Arabic word ثقافة, which is culture or knowledge. And that account posts images and brief histories of artists from North Africa and West Asia. So there's always something new and a beautiful artwork, and the fact that it's not too much information, but you get a little bit with every post, I think is really wonderful.
That's really interesting. Did they interview you?
Yes, they did interview me, I think, and I wrote an article for them a year ago when the acclaimed collector Ramzi Dalloul passed away. I wrote an article for them, but that's not why I recommended them.
No.
I would recommend them regardless of the interview with me. Then there is an account of a friend of mine, and I want to mention her because she does so much research that I really admire the energy that she puts in the account. And her name is Nadine Nouraddin. Nadine Nouraddin is an Egyptian woman, and she studies in the UK, and she posts a lot about modern art from the region, especially women. And I have been trying to expand my knowledge about women artists from North Africa and West Asia. And I think Nadine, as an individual account, is a wonderful account to follow.
And she's a student, Sultan?
I believe she's doing her MA in London this year. And so it's a wonderful account. And for instance, recently when the Jordanian artist Muna Saoudi passed away, she found an old interview with her. And she always cites the sources, and she always, like, she really does make make an effort. And it's a wonderful job. Then there is an account, it's called Emirates Books. And it's an account that finds images from the UAE from the 1970s and 80s, which is a very personal subject for me. I don't know if I can recommend it to others, but it's a subject for me where I find them posting about old teachers from the UAE that made a difference. My mom was once featured, I think, there a couple of years ago as a teacher. Old buildings, old the first schools, the first hospitals. And so this might not be for everybody, but for me, it makes me nostalgic, and it makes me connect to the UAE. I would say it's not professionally run because, for instance, you don't have the sources, you don't have the right, the images are not copyrighted, but it's just for me a fun account to follow. There are many others, but I think these are five accounts that I wanted to highlight.
But that's really nice, that last account that you mentioned. I mean, that could even be the beginning of an exhibition, actually. If I'm sure you have old photos somewhere of your childhood and all the growth of the UAE, it could be very interesting to put all that together and create something with that.
That's right, Malik. In fact, there are many other accounts like Emirates Books that have to do with Iraq, with Palestine, with Egypt. And so there are many accounts that are very, very local that I think appeal more to people who lived in these countries or people who are interested in, you know, what this country looked like in the 70s or 80s. And I think it's important for us to recognize where we were, where we are now, so that we can decide where we're going next, what we want to do.
I'd love to hear a little bit about your childhood and about growing up in Sharjah, your father. I know your mother was a teacher. What was life like when you were growing up?
So I was born in Sharjah in 1978 in a neighborhood known as Little Palestine. And then we moved to a new neighborhood next door, which had all my family members around us up and down the street. All the neighbors were our cousins or second cousins. And so it was a lovely childhood. We would leave home on bicycles and go and visit each other and have lunch here and play in the sun, in the extreme heat. And we didn't mind it. And I always surprise myself and I say, well, it wasn't cooler in the 1980s than it is now. How did we stand and play football in the sun and not complain about it like we do now? And so I had a really nice childhood. I was able, I think, even then to manage my time. So I would play with my friends, but I would go back and read. And this is something that I think I was able to balance better than others because, playing was very enticing, constant play. But I felt like I needed to read, and I really enjoyed reading poetry and reading short stories.
Do you have siblings, Sultan?
Yes, I am the fifth of seven. So I have three sisters and three brothers, and I am the fifth. And I was very close to my mom growing up, but I was a bit distant from my dad. And I think this was a typical Arab, Asian, African family, where the father, the patriarchal figure, is a bit distant from the family, working hard and earning and being the provider. But also this idea that, your father enters the house, you stand up, your father, you don't sit until he sits, you don't eat until he eats. There's this protocol that doesn't exist in some families, but you see it in some other families where your dad is almost too precious to talk to. And so really it was a very strange relationship where I was very, very close to my mom and not so close to my dad. And it was only when I was 20 that I grew closer to my dad. When he fell ill, he had a stroke in 1998. I was 20 years old in my last semester in university when I was in France. And I left school and I went back to look after him.
You were lucky that you had that time with him, even if it was a short time. And it's precious. I know that your parents were very into art and that they would take you to museums, and you were very exposed to art from a young age. But how did you independently then decide that this is something that you'd like to delve into more deeply?
So my mother having been a teacher, my father being really educated until high school, and then being really self-taught after that in terms of his business acumen and his professional skills, he gained them on his own and not through university. They were quite cultured in the sense that I remember listening to Umm Kulthum at home, Nagat al-Saghira, listening to Fareed al-Atrash and Abdul Halim, but also listening to poetry. My father would read poetry, and so I would hear that, and I was familiar with a lot of poems. But in terms of modernity, modern art, modern history, that is something I feel like I gained on my own. When I was a student in Paris, I took advantage of the city. I got a subscription to all these museums. I would go to the Musée d'Orsay, I would go to the Louvre, I would go to the Pompidou, and many other museums between the 90s, and the Institut du Monde Arabe, of course, the Arab World Institute in the 1990s. And then when my father fell ill, Malek, we were really bound, first by my father's wheelchair and his slow moving. We were bound by the number of places we could go to in the late 90s and early 2000s. There were only so many cafes that had access. There were only so many parks that had access. Then there was the summer months. So where could you go? There's only so many times you can go to the mall. And so I thought, well, let's go to galleries. And I remember going to this exhibition in the early 2000s with my mom and my dad. And the exhibition was held at the Dubai Chamber of Commerce building, which is on the creek. And it's a beautiful glass building. And the ground floor had an exhibition space that I believe is usually reserved for products and goods that the companies would market. But for some reason, which I still don't understand, it had a major exhibition, an art exhibition. And so we walk in and we see this exhibit of two Palestinian modern artists called Tamam al-Akhal and her husband, Ismail Shamoud. And they're both very, very famous modernists, active since the 1950s. And so we go in, and this was an exhibition of figurative work. And it was about Palestine. So my dad starts explaining to me and starts saying, well, that looks like it could be Yasser Arafat. That looks like it could be such and such leader. And my father naming them and my mother naming them and identifying them, it really sparked an interest in me. So it wasn't an exhibition that was, super elitist and abstracted, or works that you don't understand, and installations or things that are a bit inaccessible to the general public. It's individuals that you recognize. And I thought, well, that's interesting that, I didn't know that there was this history of modern art, even though I was familiar with Western art. That was a very interesting way of telling the story of the Arab world. through visual arts, which I never thought about before.
Well, it's stuck with you, hasn't it? Because you're doing that now.
Yeah, here we are 20 years
exactly.
later.
Exactly. And I want to talk to you about that because, you know, you've developed your own collection. And I want to just, I would like you to explain to me how you developed that. And I want to understand from you if you consciously set out to collect work that was political in nature, or was it purely that it was, I know that the prerequisite had to be modern, and I believe you wanted it to be Arab, and you were looking to get a cross-section from across the different Arab nations. Is that right?
That's roughly right. When I started buying in the early 2000s, I didn't have a plan. I bought works that I thought appealed to me. I used to travel to India a lot, so I bought a lot of Indian art. I used to travel to Turkey, and I bought a lot of strange artworks that I don't even recognize today. I don't even know who these artists are. So just like I think any endeavor, any human endeavor, it changes, it transforms, it morphs as time goes by, and you start realizing that, okay, well, what's important for me is, although, again, the region I identify with is South Asia to East Africa and North Africa, I need to concentrate. I have limited resources when it comes to financial resources, but I also don't have access to the other languages as much as I like. But with Arabic, it's my first language. I understand it completely, and I can relate. It's my story as well. And there were a lot of people who were acquiring Indian art and Iranian art and Ethiopian art and Turkish art and doing a great job. But who's acquiring, and Pakistani art, of course, but who's acquiring Arab art in general? There was only one or two others that I knew of. And I thought, let me try and to do this. But Malek, initially, the collection didn't have a direction. A. Two, it was contemporary in nature. And three, it was male dominated.
Can I just stop you for a minute, Sultan? And can you explain to me and to the listeners the difference between modern and contemporary?
Okay, yes, that's great. So I don't think anyone can really answer that question completely, because there's a famous quote where there's a scholar who said you cannot prescribe a date to the beginning of modernity or the end of modernity and the beginning of contemporary art. It is like saying when did pollution start and end, and when or when did traffic jams start. But in my understanding of Arab art or West Asian and North African art in general, I would look at the beginning of modernity from the early 20th century until the 1980s. That is modernity for me. Contemporary art are really artists born from 1970 onwards.
I see.
So anybody born after 1970 could be a contemporary artist. Works that were created from 1990 onwards. Someone could give you a different metric. Someone could say, oh, no. Contemporary art really is the last 10 years. But for me, anything from 1990 onwards is a contemporary art piece.
Interesting. All right. So your collection has then eventually evolved, and you have the Bergil Foundation, which now exhibits around the world. You have a space in Sharjah, but then the permanent collection moves around to different exhibitions around the world. Is that correct?
That's right. We have been fortunate to have a large space at the Sharjah Art Museum. Very grateful to them and the authorities in Sharjah. But then we're very active in showing the works around the world. We have now pieces on loan to museums and all over the world. And this is something that I'm keen on expanding. I'm keen on giving an opportunity to artists from the region to show. We I shouldn't be saying this out in a podcast, but in some cases we cover the costs of shipment so that we encourage museums to borrow art from the region.
And the collection is how many pieces now?
It's difficult to count, but you can think of about 100, 1,000, 500, 1,700. It's difficult to count because some works really are, they're diptychs or they're 10 photographs. Do you count them as one? Do you count them as 10?
For you, does art have to be political for it to be worthy? Or does it have to be have a political element for it to be a collectible, in your opinion?
I think that not all art should be political. I think artists who just want to paint landscapes and flowers and portraits should be able to do that. But I think that some artists need to express themselves politically. Some artists need to make a position or take a position about a national cause, a gender cause, a human rights cause. And this is something that I am attracted to. I am interested in political art, but we still acquire works that are not overtly political. And if I may say that in many cases in West Asia and North Africa, works that don't look overtly political are in fact very political. When you think of Palestine and paintings about cacti, these are very political works. Somebody who's not well-versed with the region would think, oh, this is just a painting of a plant. But it's not. It's about national identity. It's about independence. It's about asserting oneself. It's about Palestinian rights. So all these things that one must take into consideration when you think about West Asia and North Africa.
When we come back, I talk to Sultan about the joys of academia and how he has found his niche. That's right after this short break.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome back. I'm Malak Fouad, and you're listening to What I Did Next with our multifaceted guest, Sultan Saud Al-Qasimi.
My podcast, as you know, is based on people's pivots in life. I see one major pivot in terms of the trajectory of your life. The collector in you, I believe, is the basis. And I don't think that you've pivoted from that. I think that's still your foundation, and your connection from that is what leads you to other things. What in your mind are your main shifts or pivots?
Malik, that really is a great question. And just thinking, even from the title of your podcast, it made me think about what are the pivots in my life. And I'm very happy to have been able to pivot and I still keep a foot in the other lives, but be able to have the flexibility to go and to reinvent oneself and think of oneself that we only have one life. We only have, this is it. And so do I really want to do just one thing all my life and nothing else? I know that some people would like that, and I understand that's totally fine. But I thought, well, maybe there's another thing I can also do. So if you think of my life between 98 and 2007, 8, it was really mostly a person involved in business and investments and fund management. That is where I dedicated most of my life. Collecting for me, although it started in 2002, was a side thing. In 2008, I started teaching in the UAE, very lightly part-time teaching in a college in Dubai. Then the Arab Spring happened, and I stopped teaching, and I was able to take time off from my business life, and I dedicated 20 hours a day, especially at the height of the uprising in Egypt, and Tunisia, and Libya, and Syria in the very first months. And then I couldn't. I found myself unable to give more. I don't have the energy. And so I withdrew, and a lot of people were disappointed, but I know myself. I know how much energy I can give, and I like about myself that I retreat when I feel like I cannot give anymore. I recognize my capacity, and I stop myself from being overloaded. And I saw the meltdowns, I saw the burnouts of many people, and you know some of them who had meltdowns publicly because they were unable to pull back from this super super busy, super public life. By 2016 or 17, I pivoted into academia. And as every year, with every passing year, I was able to disengage from my family business and engage fully in academia, which complemented my art collection. So now I am no longer involved with my family business, which took most of my time 20 years ago.
That heady period, and we were all in the, I mean, I was in the region as well, that heady period of the Arab Spring, that year, that particular year, 2011, did you burn out? Were you fearful for yourself at some stage? Did you, I mean, you've just said that you couldn't sustain that pace. Was it purely from a self-care point of view, or were you in some sort of fear? Were you feeling a bit in fear?
It's all of the above, and I will elaborate. First of all, I'm proud of my role during the Arab Spring. I'm very proud. I have zero regrets, and I feel very strongly for all the causes that people aspire to, whether it's more freedom of expression, democracy, more human rights, better standard of living, access to education, access to healthcare, all these things, that women emancipation, all these things that we all aspire to. This is something that I will never in my life change my mind about, and I will to my dying days say that I am proud of my role, and I wish things turn out for the better, and not for not how things turned out to. The second thing is, yes, I had a fear of burnout. I was exhausted. Remember, it was just Tunisia. By the time Tunisia ended, Egypt started on Jan 25th, and then you see Yemen and Libya and Syria, and it was nonstop. It was exhausting, and so I pulled back. And I said, I am unable to give it. There is no way. These are institutions that do this.
Yeah.
They're companies that have three different shifts, and each shift has many people. So I can't do that. And so, as proud as I was, I'm equally proud of having pulled back when I thought I had to, for my personal sanity. And healthcare and self-care, but also, and I won't try to sugarcoat this, there were instances where I was warned, and there were instances where I was told off, and there were, whether it's a certain authority, or whether it's a family, or even hearing through the grapevine that there could be something. And I thought, you know what, I did my best, and I think it's time for me now to move on. And just like I wasn't a career academic, I'm not a career a journalist or a career activist or somebody who bases their entire life. And I admire those who do. I admire that, because there are people who have spent all their lives on being activists. And I cannot do that. I did this for a period of time, and I wanted to move on.
I'd like to move on to the academic world that you're immersed in now. And I know that it was from, you said 2016 was when it's really kicked in the US for you and in Europe. Give me a sense of the different types of programs that you were involved in, and I know that they've all been related in some way to always to the Middle East. Some were more political in nature, and now it's taken on an art focus.
So at the peak of my activism phase, I was approached by a center at Stanford University known as the Center for Democracy, Development, and Rule of Law. So I did a summer program with them, and they taught us about the importance of rule of law. And then the following year, 2014 to 2016, I was affiliated with MIT, and I was a director's fellow. But by 2017, I was approached by, actually 16, 17, I was approached by Kevorkian Center, which is the center of New York University dealing with West Asia and North Africa. They call it the Near East.
That's very Orientalist of them.
Yes, I wonder. It's quite an interesting name. I haven't seen it elsewhere. So, and I have some assumptions on why it's called the Near East Center. But they had approached me about a class about the Arab Spring, and I thought, you know what? We can cover the Arab Spring, but let's look at graffiti of the Arab Spring, and not the politics of the Arab Spring, the art of the Arab Spring. And I conducted this this workshop over a number of weeks in the spring of 2017 at NYU here in New York. And then the following year, I went to a number of universities, beginning with Yale University.
And how has the subject matter evolved with each iteration? I believe the last one you were at Harvard, and now you are in Columbia, correct?
That is right.
You had mentioned that you began by looking at things in a chronological order by decade and very sort of systematically. And now you're looking at things more in terms of themes. How are you enjoying that more to what you had the way you'd been teaching before?
So yes, the class has evolved. I can tell you the readings have evolved. I've come across new readings over the past 5 years. There has been published new books. There's so much new scholarship from the region. But also because I sat in and audited so many classes in these universities, I'm so fortunate to have sat in classes at Columbia and at Georgetown and at Yale. And I learned from seasoned professors. And one thing, for example, is to let the students lead the class discussion. And this empowers the students, but also takes the responsibility off your hands. So it's really a win-win. And I remember doing a workshop at Yale University on teaching, and they said that the best classes are where the teacher lectures for 10 minutes and then the students take over the class, and the role of the instructor is to moderate the discussion and make sure that everybody's engaged. Mm-hmm. The other thing with regards to the themes, in some classes I've included themes like US government policy towards the region. In some classes I've included themes of urbanism, and I add them and I remove them depending on the classroom environment. I also asked the students in the second week, do you like the way that the class is structured? Would you like us to change anything? We do art analysis. Doing art analysis, Malik, putting up an artwork and the students start dissecting it and analyzing it, I think gives an opportunity to a lot of students who are not as well-versed in the region to speak up about what they think this color means or what they think this person wearing white would signal. And so I have a lot of fun in my class. That's the most important. That's the most important thing for me, is I'm enjoying it, because if I enjoy it, I know that I can give more.
I find it very refreshing that it's kind of like reverse colonialism in a sort of a very crude way of putting it, that, you know, you're from the Middle East and you're teaching in Western universities about our world. And for centuries, it's been the reverse. And, you know, maybe this is going to create a generation of professionals who are a little bit more in tune with what's really going on here, you know, and that they would not get from textbooks in their high schools, that they would not get from classic teaching methods.
I want to share a story with you. In one of the universities I taught at, and I can say this because there's so many of them now, that my class was selected as an example of diversity within the university for the university to apply for grants from the US government. And so the university had to apply for grants, and they had to show that they're offering diversified classes.
How did that make you feel?
I felt it was so interesting, right? That so without my class, all your other classes wouldn't qualify for a grant. As in, this means that the university will have to go and review all the classes they're offering.
Do you think that academia that you've been in now for several years, do you think that's the right place or a good fit for you to affect change? Or do you see another pivot down the line into something completely different? Do you find yourself in the space where you can affect change in this realm now?
I believe so. I mean, I've had over the 8 universities I've taught at, some of which I've taught at multiple semesters, I've had 200 students, and I don't think all of them are going to be scholars of West Asian, North African art. But I feel like there's a bigger understanding and appreciation for art, because they tell their friends, and they share the resources with their friends, and they post online, and there's this ripple effect that goes on and on. And so I'm hoping that this would not stop with my students, but that they'll carry it forward with them, and they'll educate their children, and they'll tell their nephews and their nieces about this. And additionally, is this is where I am happy. This is where, and it's important for me to be content in life.
You know, I in preparation for our chat today, I went and I did some, I looked up some of your previous interviews, especially some of your videos. And you had done in October 2011, you had spoken at the Ford School of Public Policy. And you talked in great detail about the Arab Spring, its origins, and where you thought it would end, or how it would pan out long term. And the thing that struck me was you looked a bit like a defeated man. You came across as someone who was exhausted and who was, you know, burnt out, like we said earlier. And then, you know, when you and I chatted the other day informally, and now in the interview, it's a 360. I mean, you're like a completely different person. You're smiling, you're upbeat, you're passionate again about what you're doing, and it's. It just shows, you know, that you're in the right place, I guess, for yourself now, you know?
I can tell you a story of why I was exhausted that day. You can never watch that interview. I'll tell you that over 2 weeks, I had to give 7 lectures in 7 different cities.
Wow.
I flew from Dubai to Geneva to London to New York to Washington to Cambridge, Boston, Massachusetts to Michigan and somewhere else. And every other day, I had a huge lecture. By the time I landed in Michigan, I remember Juan Cole, the professor at the University of Michigan. He came to see me. And I said, Professor Juan, I need to go to a pharmacy. I need vitamins. I don't think I can stand up. And I had a huge program set ahead, Malek, where I would meet with the provost of the school, and then the dean of the department, and then some professors at the department. And then I would meet 20 smaller meeting, 20 of the leading students, and they would have not one-on-one, but a group chat with me. Then there would be the lecture. Then there would be a reception. Then lecture, then dinner.
It's a lot, of course.
I swear to God, Malek, this is the only time in my life where when I was dropped home, I went to sleep in my clothes. I had no energy. I just collapsed on the bed.
With your shoes on.
I think my shoes on. I didn't have the energy to take off my clothes. It was just important for me to last the day. So that video that you see is the tail end of 14 days, nonstop travel, nonstop talking, in some cities at 2 events, one in the morning, one in the evening. And I'm happy I did it. To be honest,
With you, I mean, the lecture was fascinating. So you came across, you know, what you were saying was amazing, but you just looked exhausted.
I was exhausted. I was super exhausted. I'm so impressed that you found that.
The sort of course you're running now at Columbia and that you've been running for a few years, do you think that we'll ever be able to have something like that in the region where you're looking at artwork and looking at the connection between culture and politics? Is that something that would be welcome here? Would it be allowed?
I believe so, with some adjustments. So I believe that if I teach this class in Egypt, there must be an adjustment to one class. I believe if I teach this class in the Gulf, I have to adjust one or two classes. I believe if I teach this class in most parts of the world, I have to be attuned to the needs, but also the regulations of the country. And I'm no longer dogmatic. I'm no longer in the sense that it's either everything or nothing. And I would say, you know what? I will make my point come through without being too explicit about it. In most cases, Malek, I find that the students are much more bold than I am, speaking about countries, speaking about politics and policies. And I find myself really in awe of these kids and how smart they are. And this is something I believe that also exists in my part of the world.
In closing, just on a personal note, what do you see as your long-term aspirations? Where would you like to be? What would you like your legacy to be eventually, if you had to look back?
Malik, I am very happy with where I am today. I don't like to make this sound very negative, but I've lived a great life. I've had wonderful experiences. I've seen it all. I've been everywhere. I teach at the most elite universities and schools in the world. I interact with some of the smartest young minds on this planet. I've had the chance to talk about the beauty of my region for the past 20 years, and I get paid for this. I get paid to spend time with smart people. I get paid to lecture I get invited to talk about the beauty of my region. And so I'm very, very content with life. And if my life were to end in the near future, as much as I'd like to live for many, many decades to come, I am content with what I have achieved. I see people who have lived longer lives than me, who haven't achieved or who haven't, in their understanding of what is important, they haven't achieved what they wanted. And I feel very, very happy. Maybe a couple of things I would like to do is to perhaps build a museum for the collection. I'd love to see that. But even if not, I'm very content with life. I'm very grateful for everything I've had. I'm grateful to my late father, my mother. I'm grateful to the, to God for giving me all these opportunities. And I'm thankful for them. And I want to persevere as much as possible and keep at it. And I don't have an aspiration to be somewhere better, because I believe I am at the best possible position now.
Sultan, I can't thank you enough. I mean, this has been such a joy and so much fun and just fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Malik. Thank you.
Thank you for listening today. This episode of What I Did Next was brought to you by ANT Media with me, Malak Fouad, and is co-produced by Chirag Desai. Please remember to follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter for updates on the show. Just search for What I Did Next.